Please be seated. Court is now ready to hear argument in 060867 Pine Oak Builders versus Great American Lloyds Insurance Company.
Mr. Yardis and an argument for the petitioner. Rebuttal. Mr. Yardis will open with the first 10 minutes. Mr. Pettigo will present the rebuttal.
Please, court. Good morning. I'm just going to give you a little roadmap of how me and Mr. Pettigo are going to split up the argument. In the 14th Court of Appeals, we got a denial of our right to the duty to defend on the Glass case specifically, and also we got denied our right to recover under 2155. Of course, our strongest argument to recover under 2155 is Lamar Holmes versus Mid-Continent, which has already been decided. I would like to point out one further thing regarding, I'm not sure this was argued, but if you look over at Exhibit 2, it shows that the actual definitions that I excerpted out of 2155, and it will show down at the bottom of those that there is exceptions to 2155. The legislature knew how to accept coverage. They accepted workers' compensation, which is not paid directly to the insured. It's paid to a third party. But they felt like it was necessary to accept it. They could have accepted comprehensive general liability. They did not, which is a strong indication that it looked like they meant for comprehensive general liability not only the indemnity part, but also the duty to defend to be covered. That's my completed argument on that. Now, I would like to review the Glass case. If you all will look at Exhibit 2, it was characterized a little differently than it was and what actually happened. And I don't think that we even need extrinsic evidence to have a duty to defend in this particular case. The actual petition allegations said that they said that Pine Oak Builders, Inc. was negligent. They didn't say Pine Oak Builders, Inc. employees were negligent, or their subcontractors were negligent. They said Pine Oak Builders. We all know that Pine Oak Builders, Inc. is a legal fiction.
Do they need a date to decide when the occurrence is triggered so that a duty to defend arises?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Excuse me. Is a date needed to determine when the occurrence happens so that the insurance company would be able to determine when the duty to defend is triggered?
In this particular case, there was only one insurance company that was involved between the time that the house and the Glass case was built and the time that the damage was discovered. It's a Great American Insurance Company. If you'll turn over to Exhibit number 3, I have an excerpt right out of the record of the policy that was in force. All the policies were the same. And if you look at the highlighted part, it says this insurance applies to bodily injury and property damage only if the property damage occurs during the policy period. Well, we know that it must have occurred sometime during that policy, one of those policy periods of Great American. And there's nothing said about manifestation in this. It says property damage occurs.
Well, but manifestation goes to what's damage.
I mean, goes to what?
Goes to what's damage. You damaged in a metaphysical sense when a set of things are put into motion that's going to ultimately result in some injury that you can see. Water leaking where it's not supposed to, over time causes rot, over time causes something that you can see. But where along in that spectrum do you think the damage occurs? The moment it's the siding is put on the house, or when?
Okay, I have an analogy on this. If you ever bought a set of tires from Discount Tire Company, and they're 40,000 mile tires, they're going to wear out at the end of 40,000 miles, and you drive home a mile, and you look at those tires on your car, they look brand new. However, after a mile, there has been somewhere. You can't see it, but you know it's there, because that's only going to last 40,000 miles. Now, this porch that was built in the Glass case apparently started retaining water from day one because the builder went out to try to repair it. So as soon as unpainted wood is touched by water, rotting begins. You can't see it, maybe, but it's just like driving home on those tires. It's there. And so the rotting of the wood occurred the minute that house was bought and the first rain came. And it continued all the way until finally they filed a lawsuit. The petition says they discovered that the thing was defective in February of 2000, which was still when the general liability policy from Great American was in effect. But to get back to my argument on the fact that Pine Oak Builders was the one, Inc., was accused of making negligent acts, we know that Pine Oak Builders, Inc. can't build a house. They have to go through agents. There's two types of agents that can be build a house. One is employees, the other is subcontractors. So potentially, subcontractors built this house. And we know from reading the insurance policy, under the subcontractor exemption from your work exception, we know that there may have been coverage if subcontractors built this house. Now, those of us that are familiar with the building industry know even big companies like Lennar Homes build houses through subcontractors, so there's probably a statistical certainty that this house was built with subcontractors. There's certainly a potential. Of course, there's a potential without using the extrinsic evidence that employees built the house. So, but under the policy that we have, Great American policy, if employees built this house, there is no coverage. But if subcontractors built the porch, which I presented in my summary judgment, just to show that subcontractors potentially
built this. What we know about the construction industry is extrinsic evidence.
Right.
And I thought you said we could tell from this without extrinsic evidence.
Well, we know that it's potential. I mean,
our knowledge that all builders build all houses with all subcontractors is extrinsic evidence. It's not in the pleading.
Well, you're right, but it's silent with regard to. In other words, this court could find that employees.
But I mean, your argument. I mean, I understood you start to say you don't need argument. We don't need extrinsic evidence. We can look at the petition. But if we can look at the petition and we're going to read into them things that we all know,
right?
There's going to be a lot of things. There's going to be, at the same time, that's going to constrict a lot of duty to defend.
For this court to find that there is no duty to defend, this court has to read in to the petition that employees did the work. You have to try to find a reason that there is no coverage. And the only way you can do that is the knowledge. I mean, you know, we have to use some knowledge. We agree on what words mean, you know. The knowledge that either employees did it or subcontractors did it. Now, I did bring in extrinsic evidence, probably shot myself in the foot by saying, here's some extrinsic evidence to say, show that it's possible and it's potentially right that subcontractors did the work because subcontractors did the work. But we don't need the extrinsic evidence. Now, the court in State Farm versus Wade, where a boat was involved, there was in the petition, it wasn't clear whether there was a duty to defend or there wasn't a duty to defend, just like in our case here. So that court permitted extrinsic evidence to show that it was about a boat. A gentleman had bought a boat policy that was only to cover personal use, and he was using it commercially. So they permitted State Farm to show the extrinsic evidence that this boat was being used commercially and so that there was no coverage. We don't need extrinsic evidence here. We know that either there's two potentials. Employees did it, or subcontractors did it. As far as I know, the law of the land is if there's a potential for coverage, then this court's supposed to find coverage. So I don't know if I answered the extrinsic question problem, but we think there's coverage without extrinsic evidence. We know there's a potential, and I'm finished with my arguments. Anybody have any questions?
Are there any questions?
Thank you, Counselor.
Yes, sir.
Are you going to argue rebuttal, or I'm sorry?
We will let her go.
Okay. Proceed. Okay.
May it please the court. I believe that there are two principal issues in this case. The first issue sort of asks the question, when does property damage occur so as to trigger an insurer's duty to defend? And the second issue in this case asks whether the court should now recognize an extrinsic evidence exception to the eight corners rule. I would like to start my argument with the first question, the occurs trigger question. And I believe that with that question, there are sort of three main points that I would like to discuss with you today. First, I would like to urge the court to understand that there is no trigger rule, there is no definition of occurs that favors more often or most often policyholders over insurance companies or vice versa. In other words, whatever rule you pick, that rule will sometimes favor insurers and it will sometimes favor policyholders. You cannot tell from sitting here today and looking forward whether the rule you pick is going to benefit policyholders in a given case or insurance companies in a given case.
Well, should that even be a consideration when other courts have analyzed a triple trigger coverage or triple trigger theory, manifestation theory, or date of occurrence theory? I mean, what analysis goes into all of that, and what does it matter?
Well, I will tell you, Your Honor, that there are many courts that do consider that factor as to whether coverage is going to be provided or not provided by the adoption of a particular trigger. Perhaps it's only that courts, when they're looking backwards, can't avoid knowing what the rule they announce is going to do.
Is it because perhaps some of these events are more difficult to ascertain than others? For example, as Justice Heck gave an example of water damage. Does the damage start from when the construction begins and continues to the day it manifests? Or in a toxic torque claim, there's an exposure to a chemical but doesn't manifest for years later?
Well, absolutely. It's true, Your Honor, if you take a car wreck, right, two cars hit each other, I don't care which rule you pick, right, we all know what day the damage is, and it's very easy to apply. That's not a hard case. Doesn't matter what rule. There's not going to be any fight about it, right? It's every test, exposure, actual damage, injury in fact, manifestation, and continuous trigger. We've covered them all basically at that instant in time. The problems arise when you have either sort of a progressive worsening damage where you have multiple sort of damage where you have a single occurrence or a single event, but the damage may continue over time. Or, you know, when we're talking in this case, for example, we're talking about rain. That obviously is not something that the insured has any control over or any part of playing, and yet it's the rain that is supposedly then what, right, continues to cause new and independent damage and exacerbates existing damage. So those are kinds of cases. It's also true that there are problems sometimes in knowing actually when the occurrence takes place. So all of those things can make it difficult to decide what should trigger a policy. But the language of the policy, at least I think we can be clear about what we're talking about. The exhibits that have been handed to you, they do quote the language of this policy, and this language is the same as the language that's in the Don's Building policies that are at issue. And that language requires, right, it says that this insurance applies to bodily injury and property damage only if, one, the bodily injury or property damage is caused by an occurrence. I think you all will remember that language from the Lamar case and those types of cases. And two, as a separate section, the bodily injury or property damage occurs during the policy period. So the question becomes, how do you determine what property damage occurs in the policy period? I think I would, most courts recognize the existence, and most commentators, of four tests. And I think that that nomenclature does become very important here, so that we make certain that when we use, when I use a term, that at least you'll understand what test I'm referring to. Exposure is one test, and it says that property damage occurs when the initial exposure to an injury-causing condition takes place. The Fifth Circuit has adopted that rule under Texas and Louisiana law in personal injury asbestos cases. So it's the exposure that triggers, regardless of whether there has been any, even an infinitesimal injury, right? It is exposure. Second is sort of moving on a continuum in time, is the injury in fact, actual injury test. And that rule says that it is the first actual property damage that takes place, regardless of whether it is compensable, regardless of whether it is known or knowable. It is simply an injury in fact. That is the definition of occurs. The third trigger test says that property damage occurs when it is manifest. And in Texas law, we've defined that to mean that the damage is easily ascertainable and identifiable. Under each of those three triggers, a single policy would be triggered, and that carrier who is on the risk would pick up the entirety of the loss, right? Because under the manifestation rule, so if property damage manifests in year five, if we take year zero as being the house is coming out of the ground, year five is some point in the future. Year 10, we'll say, is the lawsuit filed. If the property damage manifests in year five, the carrier that has the policy that covers that policy year picks up the entirety of the loss without any allocation, without any apportionment. That carrier is on the hook for the entirety of the loss. Right?
Despite language about continuous exposure?
Even despite the language about continuous exposure.
It gets worse in year eight.
Even if it gets worse in year eight.
The carrier during that period of time would not be liable for the loss.
No, that's right. Not under any of these triggers, as they are proper, you know, sort of confined to their terms, understood. But so manifestation, you pick up the entirety of the loss, even though it's worsened over time, and even though no one knew about it from the beginning.
It was not clear to me, but you're saying we're just talking about the initial trigger.
That's right.
And then it's the continuous language applies to that liability that is incurred then, and not to some subsequent insurer's liability.
That's right. And, Your Honor, it is. I mean, the continuous language occurs in the definition of what an occurrence is, right? And that's to determine whether you have one occurrence under a policy or you have multiple occurrences under a policy. But where you have it's an attempt. And really, this court explained that in a footnote in the APIE versus Garcia case. It recognizes what that language is intended to do and what, in effect, it does do in policies. And that, right, it's a way to say that even if you have this continuing, ongoing exposure, that's all a single occurrence. And that also then fits into the idea of why the this manifestation rule works the way it does. Because then we say, well, when does policy damage occur? It occurs in the year that it manifests. And then the insurance company is on the hook for everything else. There's only one point in time at which it manifests. That carrier picks up the entirety of the risk.
Wouldn't that be pretty easy to put into the policy?
Well, Your Honor, quite honestly, I think that you have to look at the way that policies do get drafted. And
understanding in the briefing is that language was considered but rejected.
I think that the Don's building lawyers can address that specifically, too, on both sides of that case. My understanding is that that is not entirely accurate in terms of drafting history. And I think if you look back in time, even over the policies that exist in the various cases, the way the language has moved forward in time, in the insuring agreement, there has not been a point in time at which there's been anything other than the occurs language. And we have moved forward in time where we have courts all over the country and within their own states having adopted particular rules.
All different rules.
It is not the insurers who are.
How can you run a business where you have one contract which means all different things in all states?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, that's why I think you find, right, as...
Why don't you change the policy?
Because we don't just get to change the policy, Your Honor. I mean, that, quite honestly, is just the bottom line. I mean, it may be that the insurance company, once it's been approved, right, that policy gets presented to the insured, and it's a take it or leave it. But that policy is not something that the insurance company drafts for an individual policyholder and gets to put in whatever language it chooses. That is not the way policies are drafted. So that's the reason that you find yourself in this position. And we would like, you know, from the insurance industry, you want to know why we want a manifestation rule? Because it's easy and it's cheap. And that is really what it amounts to. We fully understand that we are going to lose with a manifestation rule in any number of circumstances, and we are going to win with a manifestation rule. And some other insurance carrier, perhaps none, but oftentimes some other insurance carrier is going to pick up the risk.
Would an insurer want us to adopt the rule that's the majority in the country?
I think not, probably, Your Honor. I think that, I mean, in this case, you see the insureds arguing for the rule that gets them the coverage in their case. And I certainly understand that and appreciate it. But as I say, when you look forward, I don't think that you can pick a rule. Even if you pick a continuous trigger rule, you haven't maximized insurance coverage. In fact, you've probably minimized insurance coverage.
But I mean, for your predictability, writing policies all over the nation, if there are 50 different, interpretations, that's going to hurt your business. So is there any incentive for the court to try on insurer's behalf and for predictability for both policyholders and the company to just join whatever the majority proposition is?
I think if you can discern a majority, Your Honor, then that would certainly be something to consider. I think it is very, very difficult to discern any type of majority or minority rule in these cases. They literally are all over the map, and they are different in property damage cases from personal injury cases.
Should they be?
Your Honor, I do not believe that they should be, because I think that the language of the policy is identical. But I will...
The nature of the damage is different.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's what I was going to say. I will concede that with particular personal injury claims as opposed to property damage, you can see why courts choose, right? I mean, if you read what the Fifth Circuit wrote in the Azrock case about asbestos coverage for personal injury claims, right? They said manifestation is what we're going to pick for asbestos for property damage.
Where are we going to pick this rule? On your rundown of the you had 3 points under issue number one.
That's right.
We covered that there's no trigger rule that will always favor one side or the other. What are the other two?
The other two are that the manifestation rule is the most easily applied, and that's true for courts, for policyholders, and for insurance companies.
And you may lose sometime under that. You may win sometimes. It just depends.
That's right. It just depends. Okay. And then the third is that I think that the manifestation rule does, in fact, comport with the plain language of the policy. And I know that that is an argument that is made in the case that follows us also, is that injury in fact language is what most closely meets the plain language of the policy. But I think you, Justice Heck, understand, I mean, right, the definition of property damage, first of all, from the policy itself, the definition of property damage means physical injury to tangible property, including all resulting loss of use of that property. And in the law, which I think comports with that, property damage is not metaphysical. It is not not compensable. I mean, as we're talking about from a legal standpoint, right, then property damage connotes some diminution in value or some loss of function, some loss of use, because we measure property value in property damage in terms of value and a decline in value. If you say that rot begins from the first moment that water touches wood, then property damage began in these cases before that stucco, the synthetic stucco, was even applied, right? The studs are put up on the house before the synthetic stucco goes up. And then we're going to be looking back. I mean, if that's what we're going to say, that's property damage, is a drop of rain touching a stud in a house, and we're going to look back in time for that.
You know, I was thinking the same thing when that statement was made. But let's take an example of an environmental claim where perhaps you have a underground storage tank that leaks. It's not discovered for years later. Now, some scientists argue that the damage begins from the first leak and when it leaches through the soil and migrates off-site. And in those instances, courts, I think, have applied all three of the theories. And it's very difficult to try to figure out which one I think we should apply for the citizens of Texas.
And, well, and again, it's difficult, especially when you're looking at it prospectively. But
well, do
that's
we make
why
a special rule for environmental claims, a special rule for asbestos claims, and a special rule for these type of property damage claims that we have here before us? Or?
I honestly don't think that you need one. I believe manifestation, right? When we recognize that manifestation is going to be when the damage is easily ascertainable.
Is that when the first piece of paint flicks off the wood because the water's been flowing over it for a period of time?
No, I wouldn't.
Weakens?
I wouldn't say so. I think you actually...
When
I mean,
does it
if,
manifest?
Well, it manifests when it's easily ascertainable and identifiable. And there is, under the case law, no duty to investigate, right? We don't say that the property owner has to go do testing to see. So I think it becomes, I think it's the same as...
Typically, well, when does it manifest?
I think it's
when the paint flicks off because the wood's been wet, why is that not identifiable that the wood's been wet for some period of time? That's why the paint bubbled up and came off.
Well, I guess, I mean, I would say that if you know that the wood is wet and it seems, right, if it gets weak to you or you start seeing a sag, my personal opinion is that wet wood doesn't, right? I mean, I've had a leak in my house, right? So I would not say that my house has property damage because, you know, it dries up, it goes away, everything is perfectly fine. So I wouldn't say that makes
Can you tackle briefly on the eight corners rule and extrinsic evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that on that question, this court's Guide 1 Fielder Road Baptist Church case is absolutely directly on point.
Well, this
is a case, I'm sorry.
That's a good comment.
Okay. I think that in that case, the allegation in that case was that the man had been employed as a pastor at the church or an associate pastor at the church. That was an allegation in the pleading. It was completely false. Here the allegations in the pleading are that Pine Oak cannot operate by subcontractors under the law. Pine Oak is its agents. Pine Oak did particular things. If Pine Oak didn't do those things, then Pine Oak has a defense, and it can raise that defense in the lawsuit. But certainly the allegation has been made by the claimant that it was Pine Oak, Inc. that contracted to build the house, agreed to build the house, did construct these columns, poorly constructed these columns, and you cannot take those allegations and then turn them on their heads and say, no, it wasn't actually Pine Oak who did it.
A subcontractor would be an agent.
Your Honor, I don't believe under the law a subcontractor would be an agent. I mean, I guess it depends on if the subcontractor is an independent contractor or an agent, and we can't know that. But I think that those questions do go to the merits, at least touch on, right? I mean, it can't be isolated out from the merits. In the other cases that exist here, you can see that the subcontractors have been named in these lawsuits. They filed third-party actions back and cross-actions back against Pine Oak in some of these actions. Clearly, who does the work is in dispute in these cases and would be in the Glass case.
What would the remedy be? Would they be barred from pursuing a claim against the subcontractors? Or?
No, Your Honor, they're not barred from pursuing a claim. They can bring the subcontractors into that case if they choose to. And more than that, I mean, if the pleadings get amended at some point in time, then that's going to – then everybody has to look at the duty to defend again. But those things have not happened in these cases, and so there is no duty to defend without extrinsic evidence.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Hogan.
Thank you.
Please, the court. The one thing that we have to keep focused on in this case regarding the trigger issue, when damage occurred, when you can identify the damage, is that this is a duty to defend case. This is not a duty to indemnify case. In a duty to defend, as we know, what we're looking at, well, the eight corners rule applies. You're looking at the four corners of the policies, and we're looking at the four corners of the pleadings. At this stage, there's not much information there as far as actually hard facts. What we have, you're looking at a policy, you're looking at pleadings, and we're trying to make the initial determination whether or not the insurer has a duty to defend. Not whether he's on the hook to indemnify if the underlying plaintiff
But you've got different insurers the whole period. No question about that. The only question is which one?
Which one? Okay, which one? Does it make a difference? Does it make a difference in this duty to defend stage of this? Which one? We have, if we can identify that there is potential coverage in more than one policy, why can it not be that each insurer, and let's say we have different insurers on each policy, why can it not be that each insurer now has at least some partial duty to contribute to the defense? Now, later on, when the facts start coming out in the case, now we've got a situation where we actually know some facts. And maybe those facts will point.
But assume the standard foundation case. Plaintiff says foundation was defectively designed.
Yes.
Defendant says it's just Houston, all foundations crack in Houston. Is that the property damage occurred when it was defectively designed, or when the day you bought the house, or when the doors started not closing? And I know you wanted to say, well, all of them, all those people have to come in. But that's an economically inefficient way to do it. That ends up duplicating services, so we spend more money to insurance adjusters and attorneys than we do to people that have cracked foundations. So which one of those is it when the allegation is you defectively designed the foundation?
Well, that is a difficult, and especially in a case like this, where you have wood rot.
Defective design is not property damage.
Yes, okay. The foundation,
it can't be, can't, is it? I mean, it's got to be when something cracks. That's property damage.
Yes.
So that's not a, so that's got to be a manifestation rule.
Well, I thought you said that property damage is when it cracks.
Property damage, yeah, if it cracks.
What if it cracks and it doesn't fall down until 3 years later? What if you have a pier? You got a pier under the house. It cracks, but nobody walks on the floor for 3 years, and so that's when it manifests.
Uh-huh.
Now, is it when it cracks?
It could
or
be.
Or is it when it manifests?
What's your position? It could be. And the problem is...
No, what's your position? When it cracks or when it manifests? When someone falls through the floor?
You're saying that it manifests when someone falls through the floor.
You got a vacant room with a pier under it, holding the floor up, cracks. You can go in there and you can tell it's been when you finally have the wreck, it cracks, and you can say it's been, you know, it's sometime before. Hmm. Now, I thought you said that the property damage was when it cracks. Now, if it doesn't manifest or someone falls through the floor, they open the door, they walk into the vacant room, they fall through the floor, that's when it's probably manifest. I think we might be able to agree on that. If that's the first notice anybody had of it.
I think the manifestation is when you have an identifiable damage, property damage. I don't think that necessarily means that someone actually has to identify it, but it can be identified. If it was looked into, if you were able to tear the floor out and for whatever reason happened to see it, that there's a crack in here and it looks like a pretty good crack, then I would say that the property damage occurred when that crack occurred.
And do you agree with the respondent that whoever is in providing coverage at that point picks up all of the liability?
At this point, on a duty to defend, we don't have anybody picking up all the liability.
Just trying to understand how
yes.
coverage issue
okay.
works as well. And is that your view? She said that once the occurrence, once damage occurs, the insurer with coverage then, it's that insurer's liability.
That's true. If you can specifically identify something like that.
And somebody later on or prior to that, those coverages are not triggered by that.
They're not triggered, not yet. Now, later on in the case, when the facts actually start coming out, discovery is done, the fact-finding process goes into play, we have some other types of facts that come out that point to some other insurer, then that other insurer now probably has to come back in the case.
And we're trying to figure out what those facts are.
Yes. And as I mentioned, in a case like this, it is not certain. We have wood rot. Wood rot starts at one point. Nobody knows. Somewhere along the way, somebody actually discovers it.
So isn't it better to use the discovery or the manifestation rule?
I would say that under the duty to defend portion of the case, that the discovery rule actually is not what the insurance policies are about. The discovery rules, the insurance policy states that there is coverage for property damage that occurs during the policy period. And to now impose something like a discovery rule now just changes the whole meaning of that policy.
Not imposing that, but we're trying to understand when the damage occurs.
Yes.
Does it occur when you put up something that's going to leak? When does it occur when the first time it does leak? Does it occur later on when it leaks and starts to rot? Does it occur later than that when it's been rotting and now it's going to fall down? Where in that
okay,
spectrum does it occur?
In the duty to defend part of the case, what we're looking for is potential coverage.
So,
we're not looking for coverage in fact.
So you would say that
we just don't have the facts.
Your argument is there's a duty for every carrier that was on a risk during that entire period of time that an occurrence could have occurred.
Yes. Yes, I'm saying that.
So from the date of the installation through the date of manifestation.
Yes, because that's really the only way you can handle it at this point in time. You don't have the facts. You don't have enough facts.
We understand the duty to defend is much mm-hmm. broader than the duty to indemnify. But whatever the decision here is on the duty to defend, doesn't that have a significant impact on the indemnity obligation as well?
No, I don't. Because at any time when the facts come out that point to another insurance company is actually on the hook, there's nothing to stop the insured from bringing that insurance company into the case.
But if we were to hold like the Pine Oak wants us to hold that a manifestation theory applies, then it doesn't matter when the first occurrence is. It's whenever it's ascertainable, right?
Excuse me, I didn't.
Whenever the damage is ascertainable. That's
yes.
the manifestation
yes.
theory. Then it would only be that insurance carrier that would be on the hook for both the defense and the indemnity.
Yes, if there's a way that we can identify that and isolate it from the other ones. We don't know when the property damage occurred, and there's really no way to know
But it seems to me you're mixing up two things. It's a house in the woods blows up, and we don't know if it blew up before or after January 1st. And so you sue. And we don't really know when it blew up. It could be either policy, yes, then both of you have a duty to defend. But you're saying we don't even know what occurs is, and we therefore we want anything that might be metaphysically considered an occurrence triggers everybody has to come in and defend us. And that's a different thing. I mean, it seems to me the legal rule ought to be, I mean, the policy says it's when it occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And that means one thing. Now, unfortunately, courts say it actually means four different one things, but that's a different thing from, well, we just don't know which policy might be triggered. Occurrence has got to be one thing as a legal rule, it seems to me.
Well, the rule that appears to have been applied by most of the courts and in the 14th Court of Appeals in this case essentially is the potential coverage. And in this case, we really don't have to face those types of hard questions because the terms, the policy itself, which the 14th Court of Appeals focused on very intently, was particular language in the policy. Great American's policies, all of the policies involved in this particular case, not one or two, but every one of them, define occurrence. It means an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions. This is the language that the 14th Court of Appeals focused on. And what they were looking at, they were looking, doing what they were supposed to do. They're looking at the four corners of the insurance policy, which includes this occurrence language, and they were looking at the allegations in the pleadings. The allegations in the pleadings were such that three out of the five cases were very explicit that the damage began to occur from the first time the rain fell and leaked into the behind the EFIS.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you,
Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.